Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating. Today we'll be talking to Bo Mu, editor of Philosophy of Language, Chinese Language, Chinese Philosophy, published as volume 37 in Brill's Philosophy of History and Culture series. So I am speaking today with Professor Bo Mu about his book with Brill, Philosophy of Language, Chinese Language, and Chinese Philosophy, published by Brill in 2018. So thank you, for Professor Mu, for taking the time to speak with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Okay.
So what we usually start with is telling our listeners briefly how you came to be interested in the topic of the book, in particular here, the Chinese language, Chinese philosophy, and philosophy of language more broadly.
Oh, okay. I think it's the question, how you came to interested in the Chinese language, Chinese philosophy, and Chinese language. But actually, in my case, the order is kind of this. Philosophy and the classical Chinese philosophy, and then contemporary philosophy in the mainstream tradition, and then analytic philosophy, and then we're on the philosophy of language. So let me very briefly highlight my interest they changed. I was born in the Beijing, China. I recognize the Beijing environment was its distinct manifestation of the richness in Chinese culture and the humanity, have recessively impacted on my outlook and the character in multiple connection layers since my childhood. People sometimes say each of the people in the Chinese tradition is partially Confucian and partially Taoism, more or less, to some extent. Yeah, I think that's true. So generally speaking, you see there's no religion in the Western sense in the Chinese tradition, but philosophy as a counterpart of religion regarding its spiritual orientation and the social function. So I would like to say I have been influenced by the orientation of the pursuit shared by many ordinary people in the China, which, just like I mentioned, is Arab people more or less is a kind of the partially Confucian, partially Taoism. So it can be summarized in a more reflective way in the Confucian slogan in the Chinese pronunciation, the Nei Sheng Wai Wang. It's roughly the mean each people try to become the cultivate itself inside, and also try to make the society and the environment better. And when I say is partially Confucian, partially Taoism, I mean so this Confucian slogan orientation is combined with Taoist anti-toting. It's excessive. So that's a kind of background. So I would like to say since my childhood I was interested in the philosophy. There's two other special contributing element. For one thing, In my elementary school and the middle school, I grew up in the Beijing during the so-called Cultural Revolution movement in China from 1966 through the 1976. 1966, I was in the elementary school. So during that time, the Arab people, even for the students in the elementary school and the middle school, more or less involved the political, philosophical, surely the Marxist philosophy, the learning. So people from that period are familiar. Arab people are required to read the five classical texts of the Marxist. So that's also a contributing element. My interest in the philosophy. Another contributing element is my family, my father's influence. So that's a long story. I ignore that part. But anyway, in the 1977, that's after 10 years Cultural Revolution and with the interruption of the regular course of the higher education, 1977, there is the first national higher education entrance examination. So I was one of these college students after first term after Cultural Revolution. So at that time I was majoring in the mathematics, minor in the computing science. And so in the from 1978 through 1982, I graduated from my college with a bachelor science degree in the science, minor in the computer science. I changed my interest. I restart focusing on studying the philosophy. So that's how I, with this big picture, how my interest in changing into the philosophy. And then I spent 1 year focusing on various subjects in the philosophy, taking their examination, and also, among others, the classical Chinese philosophy, I think, take the 1 year, two semester courses on the history of the Chinese philosophy. It's taking all the examination there. And then I plan to take the national graduate study examination in philosophy. So I'm facing which subject I will focus on in the philosophy. So it's I think with my background in the science and the mathematics, my interest in the quite naturally is to the subject. Analytical philosophy or contemporary philosophy in the mainstream tradition in the English speaking country. So it's I went to the graduate study on focus on analytic philosophy or contemporary philosophy in the mainstream as a graduate school of the Chinese Academy of the Social Sciences. So that's where my interest in the philosophy and the philosophy language combine. It's known as contemporary analytic philosophy is largely overlap with contemporary philosophy language. So there's where my interest in change into the philosophy language. Surely, I'm interested in the language per se. I spent 5 years in learning the Russian language. Actually, that's a foreign language requirement in the middle school. 5 years. At that time, I know nothing about English. And then when I changed my interest into philosophy, just now I say I spent 1 year in a university in Beijing, studying the kind of the systematic study of the philosophy. At the same time, I studied the German language by myself. And then at the same time, I began studying English. Oh, by the way, surely, when I was a college student, our foreign language requirement is English. I mean, after high school, yes. So at that time, I have some interested in the different kind of the language. You see, my father kind of a scholar. My father studied full of the classical Chinese texts. There is a classical Chinese, modern Chinese literature, philosophy, and history. And at that time, I also have learned three different kinds of the foreign language. First, the Russian language, and then the English language and German. So in this way, you see quite naturally my interest in the contemporary philosophy and then analytic philosophy and then the philosophy language on the one hand. On the other hand, I have some knowledge of different kind of natural languages. But surely it's when I interest in language and also by language, I also mean it's kind of the two kind of the symbolic language. For instance, it's an ancient Yi Jing symbolic language in the Yi Jing text, in the ancient version. It's not, strictly speaking, not one kind of natural language. It's an ancient Chinese symbolic language. People probably have some knowledge of the Tai Chuan and the Yin Yang divided line, undivided line. And then I also have learned the modern logic and the symbolic logic. So it's always all these kind of languages. So my interest in the philosophy language is combined.
Yeah, okay. and that's great. No, that's there's quite a lot there. It's really it's interesting how all of these different aspects have come together, especially in it's sort of showcased in this book, because as you say, there's what we might call analytic philosophy, sort of mainstream analytic philosophy. There's Chinese philosophy in the sort of classical sense. And then you have also a discussion of the Chinese language, and all three of these things are interwoven in, of course, in your own personal history and then in this edited volume. So let's turn to that now. The edited volume comes out of these International Society for Comparative Studies of Chinese and Western Philosophy and some projects that were focused on constructive engagement between, for instance, in particular, Donald Davidson and John Searle and Chinese philosophy. So there's two things that I think are important to get at before we dig into the text itself and the contributions. One is, what do you mean by constructive engagement and why is it important? And then second, why the focus on Donald Davidson and John Searle as interlocutors? So let's start with the first. What's constructive engagement?
There are things at the three level and in the three connection from a general to the specific. When I talking about constructive engagement, first level, more generally speaking, I mean the constructive engagement strategy as a general methodological way in doing philosophy comparatively or doing philosophy in cross-tradition engaging way concerning any philosophical tradition. As far as the representative philosophical tradition are concerned, specifically speaking, here we focus on the Western tradition and the Chinese tradition. So it's a methodological and a theoretical concern are general as it's general. Well, it's a specific study of the specific resources. We focus on the constructive engagement between the Western and the Chinese philosophy. Here we came to Macomb mentioned, it's the project of the International Society for Comparative Study of the Chinese Western Philosophy. Yeah, this is international association. His mission is to carry on a constructive engagement strategy. I will say something about what is constructive engagement. Here I talk about the three levels, three connections. Just now I mentioned that one general speaking is a general way of the doing philosophy. Specifically speaking, we focus on resources of the Western Chinese tradition. And as far as some specific subject of the philosophical is concerned, specifically speaking, here we have the constructive engagement strategy as a general methodological strategy in doing philosophy language comparatively concerning any philosophical tradition. So basically, in the introduction to this value, I suggest and explain that the general idea of the constructive engagement strategy strategy in the doing philosophy language comparatively. So yeah, so in this way, when I talk about the three level or in three connection, we talk about constructive engagement strategy. So in plain words, briefly speaking, constructive engagement strategy and the purpose of in doing philosophy is something like this. It's through the criticism, including self-criticism, and under guidance of the adequate methodological guiding principle, is inquire into the how different approaches or different resources from a different philosophical tradition can talk to each other, learn from each other, and engage with each other, and then eventually make a joint contribution to the contemporary development of the philosophy on a range of the joint concern, the issue of the philosophical value and the philosophical significance. So it's a simply speaking, it's something like this. Surely, I need to make some note. By philosophical tradition, we understood in a broad way, either distinguished culturally, in that sense, we talk about the Western tradition, Chinese tradition, Indian tradition. I just named the three major philosophical traditions distinguished culturally. We also mean different style and orientation. So in that sense, we talk about the analytic approach and the continental approach. Traditionally, people take the analytic approach, continental approach as a local approaches within the Western tradition. We understand this analytic and continental approach broadly is a cross-traditional way. In the Chinese tradition, we also can identify the continental style of the doing philosophy. For example, as people know, it's a Taoist text, Dao De Jing, is a 5,000 word. Strictly speaking, is kind of the philosophical poem. You see, continental tradition try to use a poem language to deliver the idea. In the Chinese tradition, we have an analects, it's a Confucian way. Way is not an analytic philosophical essay. It's a kind of the dialogue. It's often appear to make a dogmatic claim, but actually, you need to identify the underlying argumentation through the whole text. And in the case of the Dao De Jing, it's a continental style. Yeah. So by the philosophical tradition, we understand it in a broad way, distinguished culturally and by orientation and the style. And another important term is how the different tradition relevant resources from different tradition can talk to each other rather than just the passing by. Talk to each other, engage with each other, and learn from each other, make joint contribution to what? To a range of the joint concern issue in the philosophy or in intellectual pursuit. By the joint concern, people probably say, how can tell? Do you mean that Laozi Zhuangzi using same language, talk about same thing? I don't mean that. So it's, after through the appropriate, suitable philosophical interpretation, we can identify something underlying deep behind the words in the text. So simply speaking, that's what I mean, constructive engagement. Surely, how to give the further systematic explanation of such constructive engagement strategy, that's another issue. Actually, probably that's I answered your final question. Actually, I just finished the monograph this month, actually for coming next month. It's my way to give the systematic account of the constructive engagement strategy. So its entitled is Cross-Tradition in Philosophy. It's Cross-Tradition Engagement in Philosophy. Subtitle is A Constructive Engagement Account. So I take constructive strategy as a general type. So different author, different scholar probably give their different elaboration. So in this monograph book, I give my relatively systematic elaboration of the constructive engagement strategy.
Great. So constructive engagement here. Then we can talk about your monograph just a little bit at the end, but that's great that you're thinking about the methodological implications here and how to engage in constructive engagement. In the contributions in this volume, you're looking in particular at philosophy of language, the way in which thinking about the Chinese language and the English language as objects of study can be philosophically fruitful. So there's multiple levels. So maybe let's get into some of the contributions then to sort of showcase what these two sorts of traditions, Chinese philosophy and Anglophone analytic philosophy, can do together. Yeah. So the book is divided into a few sections, and in the first part of the book, we're looking at problems of reference, in particular related to the semantics of Chinese names. And there's a famous paradox in Chinese thought known as the white horse paradox. There's a lot of literature on this, and your volume includes two papers about the paradox. So can you tell listeners what the paradox is and tell them what it tells us about the Chinese language and about language more broadly?
Before answer that question, I probably it's good to present the three fronts of this volume focus on, and then in that background, we move on to this specific question about the white horse paradox very briefly. Yeah, there is a three front. The first front is how it's you see it's when we talk about the philosophy of language, typically here is people based on the feature of the English language, all these conclusions are considered to be the general for all kind of the natural language. So that they somehow related to the white horse paradox case. Okay, but actually there is some distinct feature of the Chinese language. Fully was mostly explained by the current sources in contemporary philosophy, which are based on the feature of the English language. So that's one front. We focus on some distinctive features of the Chinese language. Another front is Chinese philosophy have their rich sources about the language, about the relationship of language, sort, and the world. So that's second front. Third front is we also think about how the resources in the contemporary Western philosophy can help interpret resources concerning the Chinese language and the Chinese philosophy to help our understanding and treatment through the philosophical interpretation of these resources in the Chinese language and the Chinese tradition. Now we move on to the white horse paradox. White horse, so right now is called white horse paradox, is put forward by Gongsun Long in his famous essay, Bai Ma Lun. So literally could be translated into the white horse discourse. Were on white horse. Gongsun Long himself did not use the term paradox. So paradox is added by some contemporary scholar in their interpretation. Actually, it's a controversial issue whether or not Gongsun Long's white horse discourse really present a paradox or just a paradoxical appearance, but actually he presented consistent approaches without any paradox. Okay, white horse argumentation is linguistically and philosophically interesting, so we can explain that issue in two connections. Yeah, for one thing, linguistically speaking, That's it's a white horse argumentation is delivered in the classical Chinese language. So classical Chinese language has some distinct features. Some of them pass on to the modern Chinese language. For example, we don't have an article. We don't have a definite indefinite articles. We don't have a grammatical plural form. In the white horse argumentation, so right now we translate into the modern language is the white horse is horse, white horse is not horse, right? We adding the is there. But in the ancient Chinese, we don't have a counterpart of the to be there. So Gongsunlong is just a white horse. If I give a literal translation, it's something like this. White horse, horse. White horse, not horse, right? It's a linguistically speaking, interesting. It's both some feature of the Chinese language and also indicating how is predication is possible, how the reference is possible. Surely it's controversial. It's Gongsunlong read this question philosophically. And surely if some people, a layman on the street, just to make a claim, white horse, not horse, people taking or her as crazy. But Gongsunlong make it philosophically. He come up with five different argumentation for the thesis, white horse is not horse. But actually, if Gongsunlong just say white horse, not horse, is people would render him just crazy. His point actually is this. Just for mention, there are five different argumentation in his essay. But actually, in my opinion, the second one is the most important, is to provide the fundamental rationale underlying all these five arguments. His point is something like this. Depend on what is the sort. You can say white horse, is identical to the horse. And you can also say white horse is not horse. So yeah, his point is not say you can only just say white horse, not horse. And then right now it appears to be paradoxical because he say you can say both. But his important point as I just highlight, he say depend on what is the sort. I think that's a key term. Actually, when you look at his argumentation, he said, if what he thought is a common thing shared by the white horse is not horse, you should say white horse is horse, or the white horse is identical to the horse. But if what he thought is something distinct, possessed by white horse, but not by the horse, you should say white horse is not horse. So you can say in my interpretation, there's no genuine contradiction. That's if you translate based on his argumentation, translate his sentence into the complete statement, actually say the white horse is identical to the horse with regard to or relative to their shared common feature. But white horse is not identical to the horse regarding or relative to something different, some distinct feature possessed only by the white horse, but not by every member in the collection of the horse. So in this way, there's no paradox, there are no contradiction. So it's a more philosophical interesting. Actually, in my opinion, much earlier than the Teach is usually in the contemporary logic, the first guy to put forward the idea of the relative identity, right? In my opinion, Gongsunlong is the first guy to put forward the idea of the relative identity. You see, in my just a very brief translation of the paraphrase of the Gongsunlong's point, you can see, he talked about the identity or not identity. Yeah, relative to what you focus on. Right. So I think he's He made a contribution to our understanding of the relative identity. And from that point, he also made contribution to the refined formulation or refined understanding of the, what is the law of the identity and what is the principle of the non-contradiction.
So so let's, for the sake of time here, we've covered, so this is Byung-Uk Yi. Yi is the... is the contributor for chapter one on the white horse paradox. Mm-hmm. And then in chapter two, that is, you have a reply to and discussion of the double reference account on the same topic, the white horse, not horse thesis, which we were just talking about. But then, so there's those two chapters on the white horse paradox. Chapters 3 and 4 move on from the white horse discourse, as you're calling it, not necessarily paradox, right, which originated in the Warring States period, which was around the 3rd century BCE. But, of course, as you note, there's a distinction between classical Chinese and modern dialects or topolects, however you want to characterize them, Mandarin, Cantonese, Hokkien, and so on. Chapters 3 and 4 take up the discussion of language change over time, as well as diversification of language at a particular given time. And so this is Marshall Williams' contribution in chapter 3, a comparative analysis of Chinese measure words, and then Jianhua Mei's intuitions or reasons, right? So what do these two contributions tell us when we're looking at the Chinese language?
In the first part, Mike Kong summarized correctly, the first one, Professor Yi and me focused on white horse paradox. Actually, we focused on, you can say, it's a deep semantic syntactic structure of the Chinese name. And in contrast, in the third chapter 3 and the chapter 4 appear to focus on superficial, grammatical, and level of the change, and Marshall Willman aim at analyzing the Chinese noun phrase involving the major words from an evolutionary perspective. So eventually, his conclusion is Chinese major words, major words that mean, just like the English term, a cup of the water, a cup of wine, something like this. In the English, it's seldom, not so often, but in the Chinese, in the case of the, in the modern Chinese case, it's widely. You cannot directly add 1, 2, 3 in front of the common noun, you need to add measure words. Marshall's conclusion, actually, from an evolutionary point of view, he looked at the grammatical change. Eventually, his point is human beings throughout the world share the more or less the same basic panoply of the neurobiological mechanism for expressing and phrasing the sentence we use to communicate. I share with a similar sentiment. But actually, his point in the with our concern with the deep semantic syntax structure is consistent. But eventually, based on his look at the development of the from a evolutionary perspective, and people's natural language become more and more close, similar. I think there's no wonder. For two reasons. For one thing, different natural language is also my personal view. It shares a deep semantic syntactic structure. So there's no wonder there's a natural language, a superficial apparent linguistic expression that becomes a close. We can consider the distinction between the classical Chinese and the modern Chinese. In my view, the modern Chinese and the classical Chinese, there are some differences. I mean the written language, but they share the similar deep semantic syntax structure. So right now you can say modern language is more and more like the other natural language, English. For example, I just mentioned in the ancient Chinese language, we don't have the counterpart of the B. But in the modern Chinese language, B, either as an identity sign or as a predicate, is a classification is widely used. So it's quite natural because they share the same deep semantic syntax structure. Another reason I think is very simple. We, as humans, we share the same similar internal psychological and structure, and we are facing the same world. Not where some people is in on another planet, another group on the other planet. We are share the same environment. We are on the same Earth, on the same planet. So these are two major reasons. So there's no wonder for Marshall's conclusion. And chapter four is Jinghua Mei. I actually look at things from experimental philosophy, is a recent new movement in contemporary philosophy. Now, his point is when people carried on experimental philosophy experiment to test people's intuitive understanding, we need to pay more attention to the reason behind their intuitive intuition. I think that I also share this sentiment. So the deep reason, when you just look at the parent intuition, for example, when he tests the people's giving the cryptic and the fragrance explanation. So when he tests the students, say in Hong Kong University, how they react, what's their reaction to the cryptic and the fragrance approach? So based on the empirical philosophy is a test, Hong Kong students is a favor fragrance approach. Okay, typically in the Rutgers, they favor the cryptic. I think the Jinghua Mei's point is this apparent intuition seems to be so different. But however, when you carry on, when you design experimental test, when you focus on the reason behind the intuition, so you can find this different reason fundamentally actually is complementary. So it's also depend on how the question are designed in a certain way. So if you design in a similar way, probably the two group students, their reason appear to be very close, or their reason is not so different, contradictory in the conflict, but complementary. So in this way, in the first part, you see, as I say, the first two directly focus on deep semantic syntax structure of the Chinese noun. The chapter three and the four, they are focused on some apparent grammatical change and the people's intuitive understanding. But I think it's fundamentally they share the similar sentiment. There is a people have people in different natural language communities. They share the same deep semantic syntactic structure, but we have different manifestation. These different manifestation are philosophical interest, but they does not go against. There is a same deep semantic syntactic structure.
Right. So the underlying biological and sort of semantic structures are shared, and we can see that in fact by looking at different languages, looking at languages over time, diversity at a time. Right. So then let's move forward to part two, which is cross-contextual meaning and understanding. And in this section of the book, you have two contributions, one by A.P. Martinich on communicative meaning and meaning as significance, and another one by Una Stojnik and Ernie Lepore on semantics and what is said. And in this part of the book, it's really sort of broadening out and thinking about philosophical problems of meaning and understanding from an analytic philosophical approach. Mm-hmm. Here, one problem that faces us, you might think, in both in ordinary life and in this kind of cross-cultural project is how we can understand the meaning of other speakers or other texts, especially when they're coming from different backgrounds. So that's one of the issues that's brought up. And another is this idea that the term meaning itself is polysemous. So when we're trying to figure out meaning and do philosophical analysis of meaning, we have to understand, well, what do we mean by meaning? Like, to fix that sense. So that broadly, as I understand it, is the topic of these two chapters. Can you dig us a little deeper into what's going on in these two chapters?
Oh, okay. I have two notes on this part. For instance, why I arranged part three after part one, because I think the point in the part one, joined thought, can provide some rationale or understanding is a point to provide some relevant resources for understanding and the treatment of the issue raised in the part two. That's my first note. Another note, actually, different from all of the other contributors in the other part. This is the only part, and two contributors, three contributors. For instance, they are not directly talking about the Chinese language. For another thing, their general speaking is they do not have the working knowledge of the Chinese language. But why I include it? Just because there is for two considerations. Yeah, for instance, the issue per se, because they talk about the issue is cross contextual meaning understanding. Yeah, cross contextual is just a general term. It can cover the cross tradition. Here we talk about the different tradition, different language. Cross contextual is this topic is especially relevant, interesting to the theme of this value. We talk about the cross tradition, tradition in the philosophy language. Is especially relevant here, cross contextual and cross tradition essentially mean the same. So these contributors' points are directly relevant to the thing of this its value. For another note is why I is invite Professor Martini and Professor Pong to contribute to this value, because there are two active participants in the mainstream alliteration, participating in the our range of the constructive engagement project concerning the Western philosophy and the Chinese philosophy. Philosophically speaking, they are especially special interest in this constructive engagement between the Chinese philosophy and Western philosophy. And their points are directly relevant to the scene of this value. By the way, Professor Martini's widely used anthology source book, Philosophy Language, is the first edition, I think it's 1985. At that time, I was still working in the philosophy language, Institute of Philosophy, Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. I organized, coordinated the translation of this book into the Chinese. Right now, this I will write in multiple editions. So when we translate the book, it's about almost 30 years ago. And then it's a public Chinese version of that book published. So is Professor Martin participating almost all of our project. He's especially interested in this project concerning the language, because our project is not just limited to the philosophy language. It also covers the other subject. Actually, that's related to the previous question, why we are interested in the Davidson and the Zhang Xiao. I just briefly mentioned, because it's two thinkers, their philosophy, their foreign thing, they have the major work in the philosophy language. And also their philosophical interest is extensive, not limited to philosophy language. They consciously apply their resources in the philosophy language to resolve the question, the issue in the other subject of philosophy language. So that's just quite fit. It's a lot of the scholar in the Chinese philosophical community. So they think when they read Davidson, the Chancellor's work, they feel at home, because they're not just they take care of the larger philosophical concern, not just focus on a technical dimension of the philosophy language, that's the one reason why we take the Davidson philosophy, Chinese philosophy, and Zhang Xiao philosophy, Chinese philosophy.
Yeah, and we see that in so moving on to part three, where there's an exploration of two major themes in Donald Davidson's work that have been taken up by people thinking about Chinese people and thinking about Chinese philosophy and people working in Chinese philosophy. So we have A.C. Graham thinking about conceptual schemes and linguistic relativism in relation to Chinese. And then a response by Yeoming Feng, please help me with the pronunciation there, A.C. Graham's Sinologist Criticism and the Myth of Prelogical Thinking. And then you engage in a response to the two of them here. So why don't you, if you can for us, tell us what's going on here with the principle of charity and this idea of conceptual schemes, and why is this relevant to doing Chinese and comparative philosophy?
Yeah, it's Davidson is a seminar essay on the very idea of conceptual scheme. It's a render by many people in the Chinese philosophical window is very relevant, because Davidson, the basic point is he rejects the radical relativism. He rejects the very idea of the conceptual scheme. The scholar in the Chinese philosophy is in the study of Chinese philosophy, not limited to the native Chinese speaker, and also including the adjustment of Graham, is we all know is expert. Actually, he's a British philosopher, but he's an expert in the Chinese philosophy. His reaction is negative. Actually, he thinks that Davidson is wrong. The point of Davidson's idea is not less, people agree with Davidson. But the charm of the Davidson philosophy is stimulate people's thought and think about further and deeply. So actually, Graham thing, he put forth some counterexample to the Davidson's conclusion. There's no conceptual thing. He said, the Chinese language illustrates different conceptual schemes. For example, we just use a simple example. In the English term, the shape, right? In the Chinese, we use a different kind of the different term to refer to what shape covered. Yeah, as Professor Yuming Feng pointed out, he say we have a lot of different terms. For example, in the Chinese term, there is in the English term, uncle is a correspondent to the uncle in the mother side and the father side, right? Because the Chinese language reflects there is a refined understanding of the human relationship. But actually, it's Yu Mingfeng reject and engage with Granham. He described. He explains what's the problem. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so sorry, go ahead. How does he disagree with this idea that, so Graham is pointing out, well, look, in English, this sort of concept of uncle is not as refined as in yeah. Chinese, where you have this very fine-grained conception of family relations. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So how does Feng Zi respond?
Right. Feng Zi response basically is we are facing the same world. We're talking about the same object. And then we have a different perspective. Just like the take a picture, people take the picture from a different angle, from a different perspective, and then resulting different picture, right? But however, that does not show we're talking about a different thing. We are still talking about the same object, but we talk about same object differently from a different perspective. That does not mean we talk about a different object. The Granham actually using the it's a counterexample in the Chinese, intending to show we have a different conceptual scheme resulting different world. But point, what is at issue is yeah, we agree. There is a difference. Yeah, different perspective, different picture. But however, whether or not that difference leading to the different world as a metaphysical level. Actually, in that connection, I share the sentiment with Professor Feng, but I'm using what I call the double reference account. I think I can deliver the same point clearly. When we make a reference, we always at the same time talking about that reference as a whole, and at the same time we focus on some specific part. So when we move on to what is the issue here is something like this. I think Professor Feng shares the same line, but I'm using the double reference account to deliver the same point. Okay, we talk about the same object, but we talk about same object differently with a different focus. Okay, here we focus on a shape. Okay, in the Chinese system, we focus on one specific character feature shared by some subgroup of the larger group. So we're using the different Chinese term to name that subgroup of the shape. Another group probably talk about same object, but differently from a different perspective, focusing on some distinct feature of the shape. And then they use another Chinese term to label that feature. But however, in so doing, that does not mean that the resulting the different shape. We are just talking about the same group shape, and then we focus on a different aspect, and then make a further sub classification. I think it's a big point is this. Davidson actually emphasized people. Davidson recognized there is a lot of the difference, especially when we travel to the new place, a new country, and then we come across some distinct things. And then usually we try to exactly that difference and then forgot. There is still some fundamental underlying agreement. In my editorial remarks, after this debate between the Granham and the Professor Feng, I elaborate the Davidson point. I think, in my opinion, the Granham have some misunderstanding of the Davidson point. But however, I present the two scholars' presentation as a whole. So it's other readers can make their judgment.
Right, right. And so we'll invite the listeners to maybe dig in and give it a shot, see what they think. Let's continue on then to this part four. And here we're looking at semantic truth and pluralist approaches in Chinese context. And so in part four, we're focusing on the status of truth, which is another important topic in philosophy of language. So in this section, chapters 9 and 10 in the book, what we're looking at is Wang Chong, and we're looking at his contribution from the Eastern Han Dynasty, somewhere around 25 to 100 Common Era. And what's at issue is a controversy about whether the theory of truth that is one theory of truth that is common now, which is the correspondence theory, that sentences are true because they correspond to something extra-linguistic, something in the world, whether that's a theory of truth that classical Chinese philosophers held, like Wang Chong. And so can you maybe tell us then why people have a differing understandings of Wang Chong's approaches to truth? This is Alexis McLeod's chapter 9 and Leho's Bronze chapter 10.
Yeah. Let me first briefly introduce the background of the debate. I would like to say this debate included in this value is kind of the internal controversy between those scholars who agree there is a series of semantic truth concerns in the Chinese philosophy in view of the nature of the current value. But actually, when I say there's the internal and the external controversy, by external controversy, I mean some people just deny there is a semantic truth, or there is a significant semantic truth in the Chinese philosophy, such as Chad Hansen. People already know this scholar. Substantial and a significant debate, this kind of debate, whether or not there is a semantic truth, or just a pragmatic truth. That's a big debate. I have last year, probably later on I will say something. I have the monograph book just published last year. Give the systematically explanation of the whole debate, not just the internal debate. Yeah, I will say something more about it. Okay, this debate does not include those well-known scholars, aces such as Chad Hansen and Roger Amos. But just including these people who think there is semantic truth concern and a significant semantic truth concern within the Chinese philosophy. So now, what is at issue among these two scholars, actually three scholars, which is two chapters and my extensive editor's remarks. We have different view, right? So what is the controversy is here? Giving the semantic truth concern as presented in the Wang Chong, we mentioned that. Actually, this debate is starting from MacLeod's article published in the Comparative Philosophy. He gives a kind of a pluralist account of the Wang Chong's concern. But basically, he thinks that there's a semantic concern. But there's another concern. He thinks Wang Chong come up with a pluralist account, which can render philosophically interesting, which combines semantic truth concern, but other concern. The semantic truth concern is not rooted, is not most fundamental. And then the other bronze degree. Yeah, he gives different interpretation. I also give the different interpretation, different forms. But basically, in a simple words, this kind of internal controversy between those scholars who agree there is a series of semantic truth concerns in the Chinese philosophy. But how to understand the status and the function of this semantic truth concern? Whether or not this semantic truth concern is located as a base level and or just kind of the parallel with other things and then make joint contribution. This is what is at issue. My own view is something like this. People's pre-theoretical understanding of the truth as a way of the things are capturing is located at a base level. It's a constituted normative basis. And philosophical concern with the truth should be considered to be carried on this basis. But there's another big story. I explain them my approach in a separate monograph book. But anyway, yeah, this is a controversy regarding the semantic truth, the status and the function, and the semantic truth concerning Chinese philosophy. The question is why I do not include, for example, Ted Hansen and Roger Amos. There is an external controversy. Because here's go with presupposition. This is the value of the philosophy language. We talk about the truth, we talk about the semantic truth. This semantic truth is truth and the reference are two basic semantic notions in the philosophy language. So I think, yeah, that basically there's another scenario context we carried on debate on truth, semantic truth or pragmatic truth. By the way, they are using the pragmatic truth, not in the sense people use talking about the pragmatic in the philosophy language. Yeah.
Right. So they don't mean pragmatics in the sense of, for example, the study of how we do things with words, metaphors, figurative speech, or things like that. They mean
I would like to say is related, but is not motivated by the philosophy. Let me put it this way. When we talk about the philosophical concern with the truth, we have a different project depending on which aspect, which dimension of the philosophical concern with the truth are talking about. Yeah, we have a kind of the metaphysical project concerning the nature of the truth. We have an epistemological project concerning the probable truth, concerning the criterion and the mean by which how to achieve the probable truth. And we have a linguistic project concerning the how to use the truth predicate. So in this project, we also talk about how people use the truth predicate. But however, in the debate on the truth in the study of the Chinese philosophy, people are from some more substantial point of view to talk about the pragmatic approach to the truth. It's related, but primarily not from pragmatic, from a philosophy language point of view. Yeah, I have one chapter in the I mentioned the monograph book to analyze the debate of this Roger Amos approach, Chad Hansen approach, where their point of view are located.
Gotcha. So in this section of the volume, we're looking at the question of truth, and in the Chinese context here, that Alexis McLeod and you and the others are looking at. We're looking at Xi, right? Xi.
Which part?
So the term for truth is Xi.
Oh.
Xi.
Chapter 9, chapter 10?
Yeah, chapter 9 and chapter 10.
Chapter 10, okay.
Yeah, so Xi and Fei.
You are mentioning some Chinese term? Chinese,
yes.
Original character?
Those are the terms,
oh,
correct?
Xi. Okay. Xi, yeah. Literal translation of the Shi just is a fact, reality. Yeah. So it's a when Wang Chong, the Chinese classical Chinese philosopher in the Confucian tradition, talk about the Shi, appear to be the is a kind of the is a correspondent approach. Oh, by the way, in this value and in my introduction, I distinguish the people's prescriptive, the way of things are capturing, understanding the truth, distinguish this from a correspondence approach. I take the correspondence approach as a theoretical elaboration of the people's prescriptive understanding of the truth, but not exactly the same. So when I talk about the semantic truth approach, generally speaking, I avoid characterizing these semantic truths in terms of the correspondence, because there is some other way than correspondence to capture where things are. In some section, I explain this point in that monograph book about the semantic truth approaches in the Chinese philosophy. For example, we talk about the, easy example. In that monograph book, I use a Chinese landscape picture on the cover of that book. So it's obvious it's not a kind of the correspondent way to capture where things are. Yeah, it's especially in the Chinese landscaping picture. They often use some very brief stroke and highlight something. So you can find it's kind of realist one-to-one correspondence. But it's still one way to capture where things are. Yeah. So that's, I use this example to illustrate why I think is I avoid using the correspondent theory or correspondent approach to highlight concern. Yeah, it's a semantic
truth concern. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in this section, then we're part four was thinking about semantic truth, and one of the things that was at issue was it was Shi and Fei, and how we understand these concepts in the Chinese language and Chinese philosophy in relationship to things like semantic truth, correspondence theory, and so on. In part five, there are some other key concepts expressed in the Chinese language, like Xing in Confucius and Heideggerian nothingness or openness, as well as a lot of the sort of linguistic plays in the Zhuangzi. So in part five, the speakable and unspeakable in Chinese texts, engaging exploration, this is part three, we have, again, three sections. One is your editorial response. Chapter 11 and 12 precede that, and we have Xianglong Zheng, From the Ineffable to the Poetic, which is looking at Heidegger and Confucius on poetry expression of language. And then Jiahua Chu, How Non-Speech Becomes a Form of Speech, a reinterpretation of the debate at the dam over the Hao River, which is, of course, from the Zhuangzi. Let's talk about these briefly. So, of course, one is Heidegger and Confucius. The other one is looking at Zhuangzi. How do each of these papers make connections between these different traditions? And what are they trying to, what do they think these thinkers are saying about the expressive capacities and limitations of language?
Okay, that's a good question. in this part, generally speaking, the whole value appears to be the analytic oriented. And because we only focus on Davidson, John Searle, and you see those philosophers like Martinique and Li Peng, all those philosophers. So in this part, actually, we resort to the continental resources in two senses. Both in the narrow sense as some approach within the Western tradition, talk about Heidegger, right? As I mentioned earlier, by the different philosophical tradition, we understood it in a broad way. Also, it covers by different style and orientation. In that sense, to that extent, a continental approach is also manifested in the classical Chinese philosophy. So here, actually, we are in this part, we address the three major figures in the classical Chinese philosophy. The first, the Confucius, in the Professor Zhang Xianglong's article, and then in the Chu Zhaohua's, Professor Chu Zhaohua's article, addressing the Zhuangzi. And then in my editor's remarks, I addressing the Laozi. I focus on the open statement of the Dao De Jing. So that's a well known is the Dao that can be talk. It's not genuine Dao, right? Yeah. So in that sense, we in this part, especially we address the resources of the continental approaches, both in his narrow sense in a broad sense in cross tradition engagement. So in this part, I think there is a kind of the intrinsic connection between this part and the previous part on the truth. Actually, as a end of my remarks on the part four, when I clarify the distinction between the correspondent and the semantic and the people's prescriptive reasons are kept to understand truth, I already in the address one point. But capital reasons are is not limited to the traditionally understood correspondent is one to one. It's also including the other way, either in the holistic way, or in the Heidegger's way, or in the Confucian's way, in the Zhuangzi. Because Professor Zhang and Professor Chu's article show, both Confucius and Zhuangzi actually in their way to talk about this world. Yeah, this they present their way to capture what things are. So in this way, it's when we addressing the relationship between the speakable and the unspeakable, and we need to at first clarify what we mean by the speakable and the unspeakable. Probably we still have some way to talk about, and it's so-called unspeakable, for example, the ultimate reality, the Dao as a whole. Also, it's what we specifically talk about cannot exhaust the Dao as a whole. The point of this part basically is this. This actually is we can still somehow talk about the world using the resources in the these continental philosophers like Heidegger, Confucius, Zhuangzi, and Laozi.
Great. So that brings us then to the last section of the book. So in some sense, we're kind of coming full circle here because this is coming back to the Chinese language, which we touched on in part one. Along with Chinese philosophy and philosophy of language, because in this section, the book is taking up how Chinese language use in some early classical texts helps us approach important philosophical problems in philosophy of language. So in chapter 13, we have Yang Xiao's reading the Analects with Davidson, Mood, Force, and Communicative Practice in Early China. And then we have Metaphor and Comparative Focus by Kyle Takaki. And so let's touch on these two chapters. What lessons can philosophers thinking about language use learn from these classical Chinese texts, in particular the Analects and the Dao De Jing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. let me first introduce some background or something shared by this chapter and the previous chapter. Early on, I highlight three fronts of this value take care of the things. One front is focused on some characteristic feature of the Chinese language. Second front is some relevant resources about the language in the Chinese philosophy. The third one is how is contemporary resources in the contemporary Chinese philosophy can help interpret some relevant resources in the Chinese philosophy. So the chapter 5 and this chapter focus on later two front. I just mentioned the three front. First front is about the Chinese language per se. Second one about some resources in the Chinese philosophy. And the third one is how the contemporary resources can help our understanding the relevant view in the Chinese philosophy. So previous chapter, this chapter focus on, you see this focus on relevant resources in Confucius and Laozi and Zhuangzi text. So it's basically on the second front, how is the relevant resources in the Chinese philosophy concerning language can contribute to our understanding treatment of the issue of the philosophy language. So this chapter is also share this feature. They work on this front. It's a figure out how the relevant resources in the Confucius analytics and the Laozi Dao De Jing can contribute to our understanding some issue in the philosophy language. And also on the other hand, similar to the previous chapter, this chapter, they also want to use some resources in the contemporary philosophy language to interpret important point in the ancient thinkers' text, Confucius and Laozi Dao De Jing. For example, in the Xiaoyang chapter, he was involved in the debate between the Dummett and the Davidson, right? And then he eventually side with the Davidson point, try to use the Davidson resources to interpret some relevant point in the Confucius analysis. In the last chapter, they try to use some also talk about the Davidson, John Searle, and another philosopher's theory of the metaphors, and then use these resources to help understand the relevant point in the Dao De Jing regarding the metaphors. And then I would like to emphasize one background thing. The question is, you see, in contrast to the previous chapter, you can see the previous chapter largely is a semantic oriented, right? It's a reference, a truth, and a cross-contextual understanding and the meaning, and also is a continental speakable and unspeakable. This one basically is a pragmatic oriented. Yeah. So I use the title is a language in the action. But I try to avoid using the pragmatic because the very term, the pragmatic, tend to be misleading. But so that's why I use the language in action through the Chinese text. I would like to that actually here probably reader would raise the question because there is a one basic debate about the relationship between the semantic and the pragmatic. When the question related to this value is when these two chapters on pragmatic orientation in the Chinese text, there's any moral, any lesson we can draw regarding the relationship between the pragmatic and the semantics? I think it's was all because this part I don't have my editor the remarks. But anyway, I can express one of my general comments on these two chapters. I think there eventually was all they focus on the pragmatic dimension of the language. But eventually that conclusion is compatible and complementary to the semantic focus on language. Here is an example. When the, for example, when the Xiaoyang is addressing the debate between the Dammit and the Davidson, eventually is the meaning is not exclusively determined by the intersubjective convention, right? And the Davidson so talk about the there is a strong pragmatic orientation. I mean, in one connection. So it's the people. Some people think it's probably is a mysterious. What's the relationship between the semantic and the pragmatic in the Davidson philosophy? So I think it's at that point to understand the Davidson, we always need to based on his talk on a pragmatic on his basic semantic foundation, because his semantic truth condition semantic it constitutes his most fundamental basis. Let me put the point in a plain word. Okay, given the is a debate between the Dammit and Davidson, Davidson still think we can people from a different tradition, is from a different community, they share the fundamental underlying agreement. This fundamental underlying agreement, for example, simply speaking, we are facing the same world. Yeah, we can talk about the same object differently. When you talk about same object differently is a lot of the pragmatic things, right? But let's go with the presupposition. We talk about the same object. So one of the major primary same object is the underlying agreement is the same environment, same world, natural world. Yeah, Davidson is there even given the debate between the Dammit and Davidson, they still both sides agree we can talk about the same world. Yeah. So their debate is on a youth level based on the world. We can reach that certain meaning. But as far as a fundamental underlying agreement in the, this kind of the semantic foundation. So in this way, to that extent, so I think it's there is the semantic, this discussion of the semantic dimension of the Chinese context and more generally speaking, and the language, they can be, it's fundamentally compatible and complementary to the semantic approach.
Right. Well, so this is a nice point to wrap up. We've gone through quite a lot of material in this edited volume, a lot of careful attention to the grammar of Chinese in the modern context, as well as the evolution of languages, attention to the language of Chinese in classical Chinese texts, the implications of that for philosophy of language, a lot of constructive engagement from a lot of different directions, Davidson, Searle, Heidegger, Confucius, Zhuangzi, quite a rich volume. So listeners will need to pick this up themselves so they can dig into some of these essays and your editorial interventions. Let's conclude and just come back to, you'd briefly mentioned at the beginning that you have a new project occupying you, which is a focus on the methodology of constructive engagement. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
So after the publication of this value in 1918, if only considering their completion and the publication timeline, there are three relevant monograph books whose final stages of the work have been occupied me. Two of them have been already completed at this moment. One was completed and published in 1919. Is I just mentioned is entitled "The Semantic Truth Approaches in the Chinese Philosophy." So in that book is I not just to take care of some debate concerning the Wang Chong. Wang Chong is one of the Confucian, and not limited to the Confucianism. You see, is I also address the Confucius himself and the Xunzi, but also cover the Yijing philosophy, Gongsun Long's philosophy, Moism, and the philosophical Taoism. So basically, they cover all the, in my opinion, representative approaches, also partly including the Buddhism. When I talking about this relationship between the Zhuangzi approach and the Jizang, the double truth account in the Buddhism. So basically, it cover all these semantic truth approaches in the Chinese philosophy. And then I suggest and argue for a general account of the truth. It's labeled as a unifying pluralist approach. Just as I mentioned in this book, there is a debate among the three scholars, Professor McLeon, Professor Bronze, and me. All our three think there is there is some kind of the pluralist approaches in the Chinese philosophy. One of them is the semantic truth. The question is whether or not this when you talk about the pluralist, there's different approaches. What is at issue is whether or not these different approaches could be unified by a systematic consistent account. At this point is I just mentioned McLeon have their view is quite similar to I think he's when he pursued PhD in the Connecticut, his teacher is Lynch, right? And David Lynch was he's put forward a kind of the functionist account. It's a kind of pluralist account. But it does not think there is a unifying basis. My view is that there is a unifying basis. So that's why I use, when I, in my editorial remarks, I present my own paper as the first part, right? It's a rooted and a rootless. So I think it's MacLeon's approach is a rootless. Because there is a different pluralism, but there is no. My view is kind of rooted, so that's why I use the term unifying. So question is, what's a unifying foundation? In my view, is people's theoretical way things are capturing understanding of the truth. So this I take as a unifying normative basis. I take the all these semantic approaches, the Chinese philosophies, as a different perspective elaboration of this basic. People's prescriptive understanding of the truth. So that's a, yeah, that this one is already published last year. So that's it's more comprehensive and also it provide my own account of truth. But actually, this book is a sister value to my 2009 book, monograph book, is a substantive perspectivism. In that book, I put forward an earlier line of this account of the truth, but in a different context. That's it in view of the debate between the deflationism and the substantivism. But these two books, right, actually is a sister's monograph. That one in the debate of the deflationism, contemporary substantivism, but this one in view of the semantic approaches of the Chinese philosophy. So in this way, in my opinion, I suggest a unifying pluralist account to cover different semantic truth approaches in different philosophical traditions.
The one that we have to look forward to coming out in 2020 is the one that we already talked about, which is the cross-tradition engagement in philosophy, the constructive engagement account with Rutledge. That's the last one that you've been working on.
There is I just mentioned the three. The second one is a further more systematic explanation of the range of the fundamental theoretical methodological issue in the constructive engagement. So such as the issue of the normative basis, the issue of the incommensurability, the issue of the philosophical interpretation. So in this second book monograph, I think it's forthcoming this month or next month. You can see. There's a two major part. The first part is the theoretical foundation part. I give a kind of the systematic explanation of this range of the theoretical issue. You see, this issue is more or less in the For example, in this value, it's on a philosophy language. I somehow it's either just a presuppose or just gives a brief, just very brief explanation or presuppose. So in this sense, this book is a further elaboration of the fundamental methodological strategy in this 2018 the book. The third one, actually, I start from next month. It's a monograph on reference and application. The subtitle is a double reference account. You see, in this book, in my chapter two, I just give the basic line. But in that one, I will give a systematic account engaging frequent cryptic approaches. So these are pretty much three projects after this value. Each of them is a further elaboration at some point.
Yeah, well, that's great. We'll have to look forward to seeing more of your work on the double reference, which we've mentioned throughout the interview, and then the forthcoming on the constructive engagement account. Thank you very much for all of your time today, Dr. Mo, and all our best to you. All the best to you.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate you this opportunity to talk with you, and thank you for your time.